This is Radio Free Thinker, episode 91.
When you are studying any matter or considering any philosophy, ask yourself only, what are the facts and what is the truth that the facts bear out?
Science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking. A way of skeptically interrogating the universe.
If we are not able to ask skeptical questions, to be skeptical of those in authority, then we're up for grabs.
In all of science, we're looking for a balance between data and theory. You don't have to delude yourself with Iron Age fairy tales.
The same spiritual fulfillment that people find in religion can be found in science by coming to know, if you will, the mind of God.
The real world, as it actually is not evil. It's remarkable. And the way to understand the physical world is to use science.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course, heard in Kamloops on CFBX 92.5 FM, Fridays at 3. So tune in, because it's cool. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying hello.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher, saying hi.
And this is Chloe. I'm a student here at UBC. I'm also saying hi.
And not with us today is Daniel, who apparently can't quite handle his workload, so he's had to skip the show today in order to do something that he thinks is important, schoolwork. I mean, really.
But Daniel, we will miss him.
And just a reminder for those people in Kamloops is we have a segment on today that may be of local importance to them, but bountiful, but more on that later. I guess we should start off by kicking on religion. We've talked about popes,
yes,
and we've talked about Muslims and Jews and everyone. Today, the Greek Orthodox Church is going to get a kick of the can from us. Apparently, in my birth province of Manitoba, a high-ranking Canadian archbishop was arrested and charged with two counts of sexual assault. Archbishop Kenneth William Storheim, now 64, was apparently a rector of the Russian Orthodox Holy Trinity Sobor Church, I guess, in Winnipeg from December 1984 to 1987, during which time he apparently had sexual relations, sexual assault, depending on how you term it, with two 10-year-old boys in 1985. Apparently a victims' rights group has been trying to get him charged and get things moving for the last couple of years, but the Greek Orthodox Church has been resistant to do anything about this and trying to protect its own clergy. Not much of a story here. In the one sense, it's sort of the same old, same old. It just seems to be a constant thread that seems to go through most of the established religions.
You know, though, I must say, though, it is kind of a bit refreshing to see that there's only been about a two-year lobbying effort, which, I mean, if it was the Catholic Church, it'd be like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that could be a lot better, but it could be a lot worse, too. And there also is nice that there's not a lot of legal mumbo-jumbo about this guy being above the law or that the church is the ultimate, you know, form of discipline for this guy. He surrendered to police authorities. It looks like the jury and the judge will be the ones to decide ultimately the results of this case. So in that sense, hopefully a bit better than some of the other cases of child sexual abuse that have arisen in the past little while.
So even though the lobby's only been going on for 2 years, this crime occurred between 1984 and 1980, or sometime between, in 1985. So have the boys come forward now as men, or did they know at the time, or?
The details on this are a little sketchy, but it appears that they proceed this through the support group in Chicago, which is where this is all coming out. And I guess the time frame comes out to be about 2 years was when they sort of came forward.
Okay.
Now, again, I'm not sure exactly when they were complaining about this, but the response from the archbishop himself was kind of like, what, me? No, I don't know anything about it. What are you talking about? So But, I mean, that's standard, right? I mean, it's not like I expect anything extra of a person if they're accused of a crime to say,
yes, that was definitely me.
Yeah, I did that. But you are right. You know, I mean, outside of the fact that it's been almost 25 years since the incident happened and he's been moved around, and maybe part of the reason why he's been moved around is because of this, but he's also climbed the greasy pole of the church, so no bad pun intended there or anything. But, but I mean, he's moved up in rank, so... But you're right, you know, I mean, I from what I've heard about it, and it's still early days, right? He only was charged last week, I believe, right? But there hasn't been any rallying of the troops, how dare you do this, and this is sanctity, and the church has been doing this. But I suspect we're going to hear a lot more about that in the coming future. This is one of those stories, you know, keep your eyes open, and I bet you we will be here that there were complaints raised, and they were ignored. I don't know this. I'm just throwing it out there saying, hey.
Based on past experiences, it's not unreasonable to assume that something like that has probably happened. Mm-hmm. But, again, let's let the judge and jury decide his true fate. What else is going on in skeptical news?
Yeah, well, you know, speaking of religion and all that, a story, again, that's just breaking out. And granted, this is a complex one, so we're going to give you the atheist more view of it as opposed to anything else. A story's been going out that a gentleman in Indiana was denied custody of his kids, or custody was reduced to his kids, because he was a non-believer, an agnostic. That it went from a standard 50-50 custody arrangement that he's had for the last 4 years was suddenly cut back to just 4 hours a week plus every weekend. The judge in case had pointed out that the father did not participate in the same religious training as the mother, and that therefore the parties could not communicate properly, and that he used the father's agnosticism as one of the reasons to restrict his access to the children. Now, there was no apparently case of child abuse or inappropriate activity with the children, but it seems to be a dispute between the mother and the father and their ability to communicate with each other. And I guess one of the hinging issues is her religious belief and his... He's a what do they call it when you leave the church? An apostate?
Apostate.
He's an apostate, right? But he said that, you know, hey, you know, he hasn't had a problem with his children getting a religious education. That's what the mother wanted. He's been supporting all this. Now, there are other issues involved in this, and this was not the only reason given for the denial of custody. What I think is important for us here is the fact that it was an incident at all. It was one... plank in this case at all. I mean, it seems somehow inappropriate and wrong that one's religious beliefs or unreligious beliefs would be important in this particular way. I mean, if you beat the kids, sure. If you beat the mom, sure, right? But this seemed to be an inappropriate inclusion into this judgment.
Yeah.
It's funny because in a way, I sort of understand how she feels, because say I as an atheist, say I married a Christian or a person from another religion and we were divorced and, you know, I couldn't be party to whatever parenting was going on in my former husband's home. I probably wouldn't want my kids to see him that often because I'd prefer my children to be skeptical atheists. So I sort of understand where she's coming from, but I agree that religion shouldn't come into it.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a perhaps a implicit agreement reached when you marry someone and have kids that you're not allowed to make that other person's lifestyle, you know, cause for you can't be around this person. I mean, if the person was gay, for instance,
well,
maybe in America, but you shouldn't deny someone custody of their kids because of that, right? And I think that, you know, as a good skeptic or, you know, a good critical thinker, you want kids to make up their mind. You know, you don't want them to shelter them. I mean, we may want to, but it's, I don't think it's a very enlightened thing to do.
I think, too, part of this plays into it is the psychology of the religion itself, right? Now, I'm making an assumption here that this woman is somewhat of a devout believer. And there's that whole thing that we talked about with the archbishop and child abuse, right? If it's between suffering of the child a little bit, as in, you know, they get hurt, physically assaulted or whatever, versus their immortal soul, which is forever, then that seems to raise the stakes. So maybe one of the things that's driving the mother to be less congenial in this is that she really thinks that every minute she spends with dad, that the kids spend with dad, their immortal soul is in danger, which just, I don't know, that just makes it even seem more, makes your example beforehand seem less, I don't know, salient or more salient.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, as we were saying before the show, I suspect there's a lot more going on here than whether or not this father is religious. I suspect that this is probably an excuse for him not seeing the kids. Yeah. But yeah. I could be wrong.
No, and again, you know, it's the fact that the judge used this in his ruling that's the thing. I mean, religious incompatibility is quite common. I mean, one of the things you see, at least in TV, and that's TV, is between Catholics and Jewish marriages, right? You know, mm-hmm. and which, how do you raise the children? Do you raise them as one or the other? And that's always been a right. source of tension in those communities, because both of them are pretty well established. But moving on to a more scarier topic,
More scary than this?
Apparently, Fox North has been given approval.
No.
It's not actually called Fox North. It's called Sun TV. It's put out by Quebecor. And it just apparently received its Category 2 license. And they're set to start up production in spring of next year, which is like only a couple of months away. Now, the difference between Category 1 and Category 2, this was actually kind of a victory for those who are not fans of the Fox style of news. Category 1 is sort of like basic cable, so it would have been on par with CBC News World and CTV's news channel. But their license was only a Category 2, which actually makes it a specialty channel. So it would be more equivalent to Animal Planet or NHL TV or the Hustler channel, which maybe is an appropriate analogy to that. So for all those people who are dedicated right-wing type people, good news for you. It looks like on a cable station close to you will be a version of reality for the rest of us. It's like keep your eyes open and brace for people saying things that may or may not sound sane.
Well, why don't we encourage our listeners to keep their eyes open when we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So there's a good question out there right now, and I got this from an article actually sent to us by a follower on Twitter. So thanks, Eric, for sending us this link. An article in Scientific American suggesting that stress can lead to maternal infanticide.
You mean mommies killing their babies?
Yes. That's right. So as Dawn so elegantly explained... obviously, very horrible thing to happen, but it raises some questions, sort of like, you know, well, how could she murder her own children, and what could cause someone to do this?
This isn't going to be one of those Baron von Munchausen syndrome things where she just wants attention for herself, so...
I hope not.
That's a syndrome? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I might be butchering the pronunciation, but Munchausen by proxy, that's it.
I see.
Baron Munchausen was a movie. But anyhow, so tell us more about this, Ethan.
Yes, thank you. Now, the reality is that women have taken the lives of their children under a variety of contexts, whether it's to punish the father, escape the burden of motherhood, or protect the child from what they perceive as a fate worse than death, or as Dawn mentioned, to get attention. Humans actually share this feature with other animals, particularly our monkey relatives, who have been known to do this as well. Abandon, abuse, kill their offspring, they've done it all, pretty much. We might be able to wish away these disturbing questions by suggesting that the mother is psychotic or otherwise insane, perhaps. But what about if we talked about it from an evolutionary point of view? What is the evolutionary advantage to killing one's children? I mean, that's a pretty good question, right? If evolution is true, there should be a reason why people would kill their own children, right?
Scarcity of resources, I would assume, would be one. But that's not really a problem.
Yeah, no, everything I come up with, to be honest, that's like scarcity of resources, dispute over paternity, but then that breaks down to resources, right? If you don't know who the father is, father goes away. There's got to be a good reason, though.
Well, it turns out the prime candidate is stress.
No way.
That's right.
How can monkeys have... They don't have jobs. Where do they get stress from? They just sit in the trees all day eating bananas and other stereotypical fruit.
Yeah, stereotypical fruit. Okay. Well, they have to compete for resources. They have to live in a relatively structured environment. But that's monkeys. We're dealing with humans here. Humans can reason. Humans have higher functioning brains. We can get around stress, can we not? But there's actually some interesting research that suggests that stress can be a good thing for humans, but can also be a very, very bad thing.
So when you say stress, you're not just not meaning I'm feeling the pressure. You're going at something a bit more deeper, a bit more biochemical in nature.
Oh, yes. You see, stress releases a hormone, cortisol, into the bloodstream. Cortisol, in turn, increases the production of glucose and aids in metabolizing fats, proteins, carbohydrates, even more blood sugar. And what this does is it gives you a lot of energy. So if, for example, you're crossing the street with your baby, you're probably going to be under a bit of stress because if you see a car hurtling towards you, not stopping, you want to have that energy to grab your kid and duck out of the way. Right.
Did the study make any particular examples of what might be stressful situations?
Well, I happen to have the study right in front of me, Don, and there's a fantastic quote here, which let's just draw pretends Don wanted me to read this on the air.
It's hilarious.
Whenever animals experience a stressful situation, and these are the examples, whether that involves chasing down a gazelle, escaping from a hawk, or asking a cute guy out for a date, our adrenal gland releases massive amounts of the hormone cortisol into our bloodstream. Those sound like pretty stressful situations.
Well, and I mean, it just talks about the wimpification of our society, that death, near-death, dating are somehow equivalent in our society.
Well, sexual selection is very important for the survival of the species. If you take it seriously,
True, but I suspect being eaten by a hawk puts much more a damper on my social life than being turned down by a cute guy.
Well, depends if you got to reproduce before or after you got eaten by the hawk.
Well, true.
Anyway, during pregnancy and after, cortisol increases significantly for new and experienced mothers alike. This suggests that motherhood is an especially stressful time in the female's life. I think that's kind of well established by science.
And my mom.
Sure. Sure,
definitely. Well.
This response is believed to directly explain the protective behaviors that mothers have to keep their infant from harm. So maternal anxiety increases the likelihood of survival of the young ones, right? Now, the problem is, like anything, if you have too much stress, it can be really bad for you. It's been pretty well established that even if you're under just mundane stress, your job is not going so well, you got lots of schoolwork, you skip out on your radio show podcast because, oh, I got to do a test or something. This can have a physical reaction. You can get sick. You can get the flu easily. You might not be able to eat, that sort of thing. So that's kind of like mundane stuff, though, right? Like, you can try to get over that. But extreme stress can also result in a dysregulation of emotion, or turning what would be an otherwise adaptive response into potentially dangerous overreaction.
So can I ask a quick question? Is this similar to postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, or is this something else?
Well, I'm not actually terribly familiar with those conditions.
I suspect, actually, postpartum depression, from what I understand, is deals with the dopamine system of the brain. Okay. So okay. It's actually a depression. It's a withdrawal from society. Whereas this, the cortisol issue that you're dealing with, actually, I think, is more like roid rage or something like that. So it's a different, it's similar in the sense it's biochemical, but it's different as in its cause and its effect. What kind of effects do they have again?
Well, see, the study is suggesting that an extremely high or chronically elevated cortisol level due to stress can impair maternal motivation and result in maladaptive parenting behavior. So abusive parents, letting your child die, or in extreme cases, killing your child yourself. So the study authors conclude that maternal infanticide in humans is related to the increased stress of living in poverty. Now, not just living in poverty, period, but rather living in poverty when you're surrounded by those who aren't. Because you're looking around yourself and you're feeling threatened. Just like if you are a primate and you're living in a sophisticated social system, you're at the bottom of the pecking order. So your offspring is not going to survive as well anyway, because you don't get first dibs on, you know, the food, you don't get first dibs on the shelter. So you're surrounded by those who do, and you're essentially powerless to fix their situation. So the interesting factor here is that in the United States, the highest levels of maternal infanticide were found not in the poorest states, but those with the greatest disparity between wealth and poverty. Places like Colorado, Oklahoma, and New York, with rates 3 to 5 times the national average.
Wow. So again, it's not so much that poverty in and of itself causes the condition, but it's the feeling that you are being somehow victimized that leads to this. I remember reading a documentary years and years ago about wolves and how in a pack, the alpha male sort of, you know, victimizes its underlings, or maybe it was hyenas, and that causes increased this sort of syndrome occurring in them, which ironically enough helped the alpha male because it did diminish the capacity of the underlings because of this hormonal chemical reaction, which made their position even stronger.
Well, I mean, imagine if you were in a position where you were always fighting, you're always struggling just to get basic subsistence. So if it's a struggle just to get food, and now you have an infant to take care of, and everyone around you is enjoying, you know, affluence, they have great jobs, but you're stuck, you know, in a very mundane job, you're being barely enough money to support yourself, the stress level would be extremely high, but you'd also feel, I think, very embattled, very hopeless, which could also, I think, lead to the notion that, you know, well, if you're in a position where your child's going to experience a life or a fate perhaps worse than death, killing them might seem like a greater mercy.
I'm actually curious to know, did they do any historical analysis as well? Because one of the things that would make me, questions that come to my mind, is in the olden days where women would have 15 children, so they're kind of constantly in this state of birth stress, right? Whether they were more likely or less likely, or whether you developed a tolerance to it. And also, I mean, the disparities may have been greater or lesser back then, depending on your community or whatever, but they didn't do any historical comparisons?
I don't know if they've done any historical comparisons. I mean, the first thing that I think of, though, when we go back in time is that even if mothers had 15 children, it's unlikely that they would survive just on their own through lack of resources. So it's hard to say. It would be an interesting, perhaps, sociological or historical research project to sort of go back and look at, you know, what are the factors historically that led to?
Well, and I mean, like, going back like 200 years, right? So I mean, you know, women died a lot in childbirth, but there were a significant number of women who would have.
But the children also just would die like at the age of 5 because they couldn't get enough food, right?
True.
Really a fun topic to sink our teeth into. Obviously, why don't we go to a commercial break and we'll come back with more here on Radio Freethinker.
Robots need love too.
This is Dan Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver and the surrounding university area.
They want to be loved by robots, need love too. They want to be loved by you.
Yeah, the state of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
So, joining us now on Radio Freethinker, we have the author of the popular blog Blaghag, as well as the creator behind the phenomenon known as Boobquake, Jen McCright.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. So, hi, this is Chloe. I don't know if Ethan said that, but hello.
I didn't.
Oh, that's all right. Just a little intro for Jen. Jen is a student. Correct me if I'm wrong.
All right, definitely.
Jen is a student of evolutionary biology, and you just started your PhD at UW, right?
Yep.
Awesome. And she describes herself on her blog, Blaghag, as, quote, a liberal, geeky, nerdy, scientific, perverted, atheist, feminist, unquote. So that's, like, the best recommendation ever.
Thanks. I'm glad you think that.
Awesome. So, I'm going to start off with, like, a super, super general question. I'm really, really new to the skeptic community.
Sure.
And I'm coming to this issue of women in the skeptical / atheist movement with a bit of, skepticism. because I found the skeptical community to be unique in that it's very, very accepting of feminism and of women. So, with some genuine ignorance, I ask a very general question. How big and what are the issues facing women in the skeptical movement?
Well, I think you're right to be somewhat skeptical, because I think since this is such a huge topic, it makes it seem like it's a huge problem. And
right.
It is an issue, but skeptics and atheists, I think, do a better job of being more open and welcoming to women. Compared to other, like, religious meetings I've been to, a lot less sexism going on. I feel much more comfortable attending these meetings. I think where the current debate is coming is that there's still room to improve.
Right.
That when you go to a skeptical meeting, often it's still the majority of attendees are men, and the majority of speakers are men. And just sort of making sure that those communities are still welcoming to women. Like, how can we get it to be more equal? Like, what are we sort of missing? So it's not that we're screwing everything up. It's not that it's horrible, but it's just that there's still room to improve, and we sort of want to fix the diversity issue now while we still can, instead
right.
of, you know, 30 years down the line when it's already cemented in our certain demographics.
Now, you've seen a couple of talks that Greta Christine has given.
Yeah, definitely.
This. Yeah, and so are is sort of part of your plan / attitude towards this informed by her stuff?
Definitely. I love Greta Christine.
Yeah,
she's one of my favorite bloggers. And she's spot on. She has a talk, you can find it through YouTube also, that's on how diversity in the atheist movement, what we can learn from the GLBT movement.
Yeah.
And one of the main things from the GLBT movement is that they had a lot of issues early on where they excluded a lot of minorities from the movement, maybe not consciously, but it just sort of happened that they weren't as welcoming to them. And now they have a lot of problems because of that. There are a lot of people of color, minorities, that don't feel as welcome in the GLBT movement because it's already established that way. So we don't want to sort of follow in their footsteps and do the same thing where minorities don't feel as welcome because we kind of accidentally set it up that way. So sort of, you know, nipping the problem in the butt now while it's not as big of an issue.
Yeah, and I think that's something that it's hard to find a mechanism for. You know what I mean? Like, and I remember on Skeptic, Elise was posting about maybe starting, like, an outreach program for women or something like that. And that makes me nervous. I feel like we're sort of, like, jumping the gun a little.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you want to comment?
I think the problem is there's no easy solution. But I think sort of what Elise is doing isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think her organization's called Women Thinking Free.
Okay.
And I spoke there, and they were a great group. And, you know, most of them were women, but there were still a lot of men who attended.
Okay.
So it wasn't just, you know, like a women's only club. But it really got women interested because it gave them a safe environment. They knew that they can show up to this place, and they weren't going to have people constantly asking them on dates or hitting on them or, you know, heckling them. It was kind of a label that let the people know it was safe. So something like that just might make a safe environment first, so when they start going to Women Thinking Free meetings, then later they'll be like, oh, I want to go to TAM or something. They'll kind of,
right.
you know, move on to the general meetings. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Cool. Which actually brings me to my next question. I'm sort of, again, new to the skeptical community. I'm getting the impression that these issues are not really specific to the skeptic community as such. Like, mm-hmm. we're inheriting them from sort of like a broader cultural
definitely. It's like I said, I think skeptical community is much better at dealing with sexism than other communities are. But it's just the fact that we live in a sexist society, and, you know, people who are skeptics come from that society, so sometimes you might unconsciously be doing or saying something, even though you're not intending to be sexist or excluding women, but it still happens because it's just so ingrained in us, and it's really hard to kick that habit. So it's not really skepticism's problem, but we can try to also fix it.
Right. Cool. Well, I was looking through your blog the other night, and we actually recently talked about the science cheerleaders on Radio mm-hmm. Freethinker, and you posted a blog post about that, which I really appreciated, because you're, like... Correct me if I'm misrepresenting you, but sure. basically you were saying it's okay to be sexy and smart and women can do what they like.
Definitely.
Awesome. Good. So do you think there's, I mean, how much room is there in like what's supposed to be a rational movement like ours to cement that kind of attitude that it's okay, it really is logical for women to do what they like?
Yeah. Well, I think that's sort of, whenever I give my talk about Boobquake and sort of how that happened, I try to make a point that, you know, it's okay for women to dress how they want and to mm-hmm. be feminine if they want to be feminine, and that it's sort of all options are okay. It's not about acting a certain way. And I sort of try to, you know, teach by example, I guess, the fact that I'm a young woman and, you know, I might wear a low-cut shirt every once in a while, but I'm still saying intelligent things and sort of trying to prove people wrong that, you know, dressing sexy doesn't necessarily mean you're stupid. But it's just something that we need to keep repeating, I think, because people have these stereotypes that, oh, if you're a cheerleader, you're automatically dumb because you're pretty.
Right.
Two things are mutually exclusive, and they're not. And if we keep treating it that way, women who might be interested in feminine things are going to be less interested in getting involved in the skeptical movement because they're going to feel like it's not for them. They're not allowed to be a part of that.
Right.
Not taken seriously.
Masculinizes them in some way.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you had any response to that blog post, out of curiosity?
Most of it's been, I guess, agreeing with me to a certain extent, from my readers at least, but I haven't checked recently. But there's been back and forth across various blogs, so not every woman agrees on this, so it's a contentious issue, I guess.
Feel free to jump in anytime.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned sort of making the environment woman-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest controversies that erupted recently was Phil Plait's Don't Be a Dick.
Yeah.
Should perhaps he have said, don't be a annoying person, or...
See, that's something I didn't have a problem with.
I didn't have a problem with it either. You know, I think it's just
a
terminology people use, so I didn't really have an issue with it.
Okay.
I think he was just trying to be funny, you know, so I didn't take it personally. Yeah. You know, women can be around people using bad language. It doesn't, you know, that's not something that automatically...
Right, but it's generally, when you say don't be a dick, it generally applies more to the masculine side, just sort of physiologically.
Right. Very diplomatically put.
Yeah. But another question, I mean, TAM has been criticized in the past for not doing enough to include women. I think mm-hmm. this past TAM, they had a lot of feminism and skepticism workshops, but the previous TAM, I think, was under fire for having very few women speakers. I was recently at the Secular Humanism Conference in Los Angeles, and they only had about two or three women speakers.
Yeah.
And I think Greta Christina mentioned this as well, that you kind of have to make an effort to find women speakers.
Yeah.
Was that your take as well? Or?
Yeah, so I've only been to the most recent TAM, so I can't personally judge what they were in the past, but I've been talking to a lot of people about this because I'm interested in it, and people say that it is getting better, that compared to the past, there are a lot more women speakers. And I talked to Jeff Wagg a little bit, who helps organize all these things, and he basically said that, you know, they do invite a lot of women speakers, but only so many people say yes. And think about it, if women are already in the minority, and you're being asked to speak at every single conference, you can't do it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's hard on the women who are the speakers, too. But I think that they are making an effort to get more women speakers, and one of the points I make is that when you have women speakers, it's not also just about having them speak about being women, too. Like, it was really awesome that they had at least a panel on women in skepticism, and the fact that I'm talking today about bringing women to skepticism, that stuff is needed to bring awareness. But at the same time, all those women on those panels have their skeptical things that have nothing to do with being a woman that they can talk about. Exactly. And it's like, you know, let them talk about that too and prove that women aren't just there to be women. They're there because they can talk about, you know, anti-vaxxers or whatever skeptical thing they do.
Mm-hmm. So is there a bit of a, I don't know, my biology is really bad, so I don't know if this is like a negative or a positive feedback loop, but is there a bit of a feedback loop in that there aren't a lot of women in skepticism, so there aren't a lot of speakers, so not a lot of women come to skepticism?
Yeah, I think it's definitely that sort of loop, and that's why a lot of people, when you say, you know, you should have more female speakers, they're like, oh, you shouldn't base someone on their gender for if they should speak or not. And that's not the point. The point is that there are women who are good speakers, or just as good as the men, or even better, and for whatever reason, we might miss them, because we're not as aware of them. But if we put them in there to begin with, then we start getting that positive feedback loop. Like, I know at my events or at Greta Christina's events, there are a lot more women in the audience who come to those events compared to male speakers because they feel more comfortable or we're talking about an issue that's more relevant to them. And once you start getting more people coming, then maybe they'll start their blog and they'll get popular. You never know. So it's sort of, it does help when you kind of get the ball rolling, but the main pushback is where people think that, oh, I don't want to, you know, just have women speakers for the sake of them being women, because, you know, we don't want to do that, but at the same time, that's, it does help get more people involved, and those women are just as deserving to be speakers, too.
So to what extent is this sort of like a two-way street? Like, we should empower women to speak out in skepticism, but we should also empower women to feel comfortable at male-dominated events.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, it's both the sort of attendees and the speaker issue.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about leadership in the movement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, James Randi, Ron Lindsay, Richard Dawkins, those guys are all, they're all dudes.
Yeah.
Do we need to make a bigger effort to get women in places of visible leadership in the community so that when the media comes calling, they don't always just go to Richard Dawkins, they go to Jen McCrae, for instance?
I don't know if they should be going to me yet. but there are definitely women who they should be going to. You know, Harriet Hall, Pamela Gay, those are all excellent speakers. Even Rebecca Watson, you know, she's still newer to the movement, but she's a, you know, voice to be contented with. She's very eloquent at what she says. But there are plenty of women speakers who are just as eloquent as the male leaders, but they don't really have official leadership positions, and so sometimes the media doesn't pay as much attention to them. But even within the atheist movement, there are plenty of women who have official leadership positions, like Annie Laurie Gaylor is the head of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, and people still sort of forget about her when they're talking about atheist leaders. They, you know, mention Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, that sort of thing. So, I mean, we can try to put more people in leadership, but it's also sort of on the media's side that they have to do something in sort of recognizing it, too. So I think it definitely would help to have more women in leadership positions, but...
So our listeners will not be listening in to the talk you're about to give, so do you want to give sort of like an abridged, very quick abridged version about bridging the gender... Oh, God, I'm totally punning by accident. Bridging the gender gap in the skeptical atheist movement.
Sure. So part of the talk, I just sort of give some pointers, you know, how we can do that, and some we've already discussed. But there are a couple other things to consider, like I mentioned, when you're choosing your venue, you have to think about the needs of women, too. If every time you meet, it's in a pub, women who have small children probably not going to be able to come if they can't bring their kid or they can't find a babysitter or something. So maybe just having more family-friendly events where children are explicitly invited, or just areas where you can have children. Or at big conferences like TAM, like having some sort of, well, TAM's in Vegas, so maybe that's not a good idea, but any sort of big...
There are kids' casinos in Vegas.
Yeah, this is true, yeah. But any sort of big conference, maybe having like a daycare service, like a room. I know I've gone to biology conferences that have that. They have a side room where you can kind of drop your kids off and have them babysat for the day. So things like that. Another thing I make a point of mentioning is that, like we said, there's not one right way to be a woman. So even... you know, men and women alike are often criticizing women for acting a certain way. So, like, I get a lot of criticism on my blog because I talk about sex so much and people say, oh, you're just doing it for attention. It's like, no, I'm interested in it. I think it's a cool topic. And, you know, even from older women in the skeptical movement, I get messages saying that, like, I'm basically selling out by doing this and that, you know, just wait until you're older and you're not this cute young girl and no one's going to pay attention to you anymore. And you'll see how it's like that people are paying attention to you just for, you know, the sexy side and not for your brains. And I don't think that's right to go around telling people that. You're really going to alienate a lot of women who want to get involved in the movement if you're saying that's the only reason why people care what you're saying. So...
That's very below the belt. I'm on your side.
Yeah, it's a little rough, you know, you can't take everything people say on the internet too seriously. So, it's a thick skin to be a blogger. But.
You look like you want to jump in, Ethan.
No, that was a good point.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to depart from feminism a little, and again, going back to one of your blog posts, why atheism is the most skeptical position.
Uh-oh.
No, it's good, don't worry. So for anyone who hasn't read a particular blog post, you mentioned having gone to a panel discussion in Seattle which talked about atheism versus skepticism. Mm-hmm. And first of all, the fact that there's like a verses in there completely mystifies me. But, you know.
Yeah, me too. But
so I totally agree with the idea like of atheism being the most skeptical position, but one thing I found really interesting about the discussion that you were discussing mm-hmm. was that liberal religious people aren't considered skeptical. So, what was that all about?
So I want to clarify that.
Please.
Because I think people are sort of misinterpreting what I was saying.
Okay, go
but
for
I
it.
Think liberal religious people can definitely be skeptical and
right.
definitely be better skeptics than some atheists, most atheists even. There are plenty of atheists who aren't skeptical about anything other than even not very skeptical about religion. They're just atheists for whatever reason. But I think it's very possible to not be skeptical about certain topics.
Right.
And there's certain topics that I will admit, you know, when it comes up, it's really hard for me to be skeptical about them, that it's just I know I fall into the same patterns. And I think there are some skeptics out there who aren't skeptical about religion, that's their little pet thing where they compartmentalize it and they don't question it as much as they question homeopathy or astrology or any other skeptical topic. So I wouldn't say someone's not being a skeptic, but I would say they're not being skeptical about a certain topic.
So is there a distinction to be made here between, like, lowercase skeptic, like, S skepticism and, like, uppercase?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, the label skeptic, I would still say that person's a skeptic, but I would say on that one issue, they're not being skeptical, which, you know, what human being is skeptical about everything?
Right.
You know, there's something everyone's not as skeptical about.
That's true. Thoughts? Any thoughts, Ethan?
Ethan's skeptical about everything.
I mean, kind of, yeah. But, no, I'm just curious, like, there's been some criticism that certain people in the movement who maintain religious beliefs are sort of committing some pretty big eternal logical fallacies, that mm-hmm. they're defending science when it comes to astrology and homeopathy, but at the same time they believe that, you know, Jesus is going to come back to life someday and fix the world. And that by criticizing them, we're attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, should not a good skeptic be prepared to defend their views, whatever they be?
Well, I agree, and, you know, I'm more active in the atheist movement, honestly, that I sort of came to the skeptical movement through the atheist movement.
Right.
Which a lot of people do that. And I think you should be able to criticize religious belief. That's one of my big things, that it shouldn't be a sacred cow, that it's just an idea like any other idea, and it should stand up to criticism. And I don't see it as necessarily attacking. But the problem is when beliefs are so personal to someone, people will see it as an attack.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you shouldn't stop questioning it just because it hurts someone's feelings at the same time. So I think, you know, we definitely have to be, you know, not try to be a dick about it, I guess, to an extent. Like, I wouldn't go up to a skeptic who's religious and be like, you're not a skeptic, you know, you're being stupid about this. I wouldn't ever really want to confront that person personally. But if I'm planning a conference and one of the talks happens to be about being skeptical of religion, I don't think they should be freaking out about that, because
mm-hmm.
it's a topic like anything else. You know, you wouldn't ask a conference to not talk about homeopathy because that's the one thing you believe in and you're skeptical about everything else. That it should sort of have fair treatment, just like any other belief.
Right. So this sort of gets into the confrontation versus accommodation method of skepticism and atheism. And this is, again, going back to gender. I sort of seem to find that I mean, this may be a cultural thing as well, but the women tend to be a bit more accommodating and the men tend to be a bit more confrontational. So, I'm not entirely sure how to ask that question, but, I mean, should women be more confrontational and men more accommodating? Like, is there a kind of a way to navigate that?
Well, one, I think you see that general trend just because that's sort of how society teaches women to be.
Exactly.
It's not that women are necessarily less confrontational biologically.
Right.
It's just that...
No, certainly not.
No, I just want to make that clarification because there are people who make that argument that women are, you know, they're demure animals and that's how they need to act. Yeah.
Like cats.
Giggling is appropriate. Yeah. But there are plenty of women who are very confrontational. I think I'm fairly confrontational on my blog. Greta Christina, she's fairly confrontational. She doesn't really mince words. Rebecca Watson, you know, all the I don't want to lump myself with the big name people, but the bigger name people are fairly confrontational.
Right.
You know, there are men who aren't as confrontational, just like Hemant Mehta. He's somewhat confrontational, but he's, you know, he's known as the friendly atheist. He's known as being very diplomatic. But my big thing, I don't even know why this is a debate anymore.
I know.
Because, you know, everyone do what you're good at. And every situation sort of requires different tactics, too. Like, sometimes it really works being confrontational. Sometimes it really works being diplomatic. Sometimes it works having both, you know, the good cop, bad cop routine sort of thing. Sometimes something in the middle is better. So I don't think there's one right way to do it. So I personally don't even know why it's a debate anymore. It's like, let people do what they're good at, and then it should work from there, yeah.
So are you finding any very subtle, I assume there are going to be subtle differences between your experience of skepticism in the United States and your brief stay in Canada?
Not really differences in skepticism. There are other differences.
Sure.
But I was joking earlier that I was saying, oh, Canadians seem so stereotypically polite. The stereotype is true, but I think that's confirmation bias that, you know, I'm looking for it. And so
we're an especially polite, skeptical group.
Yes,
yeah.
We are.
So there hasn't really been, like, you haven't really noticed, like, a big difference in the community so far. I'm just, like, I have no idea if there's anything to look for. I'm just asking.
Well, I gave a talk on the Creation Museum last night.
You did.
And I think there's about equal amounts of looks of horror than when I've given it to American groups. But I think it was the people here were slightly more incredulous just because, you know, back in the United States, a lot of people who are atheists, they came from religious families. Mm-hmm. And I asked a question at another meeting here for my feminism talk. And I'm like, oh, well, you know how hard it is to leave religion. And only one person in the room had come from a religious family. I'm like, I'm so used to it being 80% or something.
Right.
And so it was sort of different, you know, playing off that demographic. But otherwise, no, there's not some huge divide between Canadian and American skeptics.
You'd probably see a less of a difference. Canadian cities tend to be a lot more liberal than their rural counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's quite the same in the States. I think it's actually a bit closer to more of a melding. But Vancouver especially, pretty apathetic when it comes to religious matters.
Yeah.
People just kind of don't care too much.
We have a pretty big woo community, though.
Oh, yeah. Vancouver's big on homeopathy and alternative medicine,
yeah,
acupuncture. That's our crazy thing.
That's what I noticed because I just moved from the Midwest to Seattle. And Midwest, very religious, not so much into the woo things. But Seattle, not religious, into the woo things. So I don't know if it's like they replace one thing with another. I don't know how that works. But
gosh, I have so many questions I want to ask you. I don't really know where to, like... have you gotten, like, some, like, incredible kind of positive feedback from, like, your blog or anything? Someone you've really inspired, a woman or otherwise, to speak out in the skeptical movement or to leave religion or to leave woo or any, you know, anything like that?
Yeah, I get emails like that all the time, and they're great when, you know, maybe I've gotten some from women who are like, thanks, you know, for speaking out for us and making our voices heard. People have started blogs after reading my blog. The ones I really like, too, I get emails from men being like, hey, Jen, you know, when I first heard the word feminist, I had these horrible stereotypes about them, but now I realize they're all pretty much wrong, and yes, I am a feminist, too, and I support women's rights and all these sort of things. It's sort of the fact that I could reach someone who was originally, you know, anti-feminist and kind of changed their mind on the topic, that those, you know, that means a lot to me, too. But I've definitely had people who used to have skeptical beliefs, and they write me saying that, or not skeptical beliefs, they're superstitious beliefs, and now they're like, oh, I'm a skeptic now, you know, I'm thinking about these things a lot more critically. So those emails are definitely very cool.
That's cool. So how much dialogue goes on between you and the other sort of big names, women big names in the skeptical
movement? Well, I would say Greta and I are friends.
Cool.
I've talked to Rebecca Watson a couple times, and we've done some podcasts together, but I don't like, not like best buddies, I don't chat all the time. I just was speaking at Harriet Hall's group because she's based in Seattle, so that was nice talking to her, so we talked a little bit over email. So there are some connections there. But, yeah, I'm still getting started, too, so
right.
I'm sure.
So to what extent is sort of the norm for feminism in the skeptical movement not the crazy, women should not behave this way, and that women should not behave this way amazing.
Feminism at its simplest is just equality between the sexes.
Right.
It's not even, you know, necessarily pro-women, women have to take over the world sort of thing.
Right.
It helps men, too, because
right.
there are plenty of sexist things that affect men negatively. And I would just say, you know, realizing that women can just be as good as skeptical thinkers as others, and they're, you know, they're not coming to your conferences just so you can have someone to date. They're there because they actually want to contribute too. It's just that it's simplest.
So do we have more like pro-women feminist and skeptic movement, or do we have like more pro-equality from your experience?
I don't know if I've been in the skeptical movement long enough to say to judge, but I think they're definitely both. I don't know. I think it's partially a generational thing, even within feminism, that I don't know if you're as familiar with feminism, but there's like the first wave feminist,
right,
second
right,
wave feminist,
right.
third waves. People call me a third waver,
because
I talk about sex too much, pretty much. That's what makes you a third waver. But there are definitely probably some second wave feminists in the skeptical movement. I think that's where I get a lot of my criticism from, because it's not so much that it's because of their skeptical background. It's because second wavers and third wavers kind of clash sometimes,
right.
and what they think is more important issues to deal with. And so I think there are definitely some older women in the skeptical movement who sort of take a different approach than I do, which is fine. But
yeah, sounds good. All right. Well, thank you very, very much for being with us. It's great to have you up here in Canada.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good luck with your studies.
Thanks.
CITR 101.9 FM. It's what the whales are talking about.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So our thanks to Jen for the interview and, giving our show a nice positive swing after all the dead babies.
And props to Chloe for a very excellent, good first interview.
Thank you very much.
Very well done. Let's go on to our thank you. Let's go on to our skeptical highlights, as it is the end of the show. Don?
Yes, so I've got kind of two. I'm going to get one off quickly, doing a priming of the pump. Next episode, we're hoping to do a Christmas gift episode. Now, this is going to be done in two parts. One, if you see a gift out there that's just like, oh my God, I cannot believe that they're selling this. It is such wackadoodle. Send us an email and say, hey, you guys should do something about this in case some poor fool tries to buy it. Or conversely, if you see something out there that's just like, this is going to be the perfect gift for the skeptic mind, try and avoid books. Books are done to death. Send it to us.
And they're boring, too.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to bring your note out is we're at a really unique point in history right now. WikiLeaks has released another set of documents, which I recommend everyone downloading. It's called Cablegate, and most torrent sites will have it. It's a bunch of documents they got from the United States government. But one of the things that's really interesting about it is it's the idea of shedding light onto the dark recesses of politics and what's behind the scenes. Now, we could do a whole show about the morality and ethical of it. We're not going to do that for the moment. But it's definitely something to keep your eyes on, because I suspect after this one plethora of releases that WikiLeaks has done, either A, no one's going to write anything down, even in an email, or B, it's going to be so hard to get a hold of, we'll never again be able to get this unique insight into how things work behind the scenes.
It's sort of like when a scientist goes out to study like lions or something, and then the lions see the scientist, and they all kind of like eat the scientist or something, and then like walk off.
I was going to say that's exactly
what it's like.
Yeah. I was going to use the Nazis, right? Because everyone knows the Nazis were really meticulous about their documentation, about everything they did, because they assumed that no one would ever see it except for people who were part of it. And then after the war, every genocide after that was paperless genocide, right? Now they can't even have electronic stuff because that's been compromised. So, anyhow. But that's just life. But it's cool. Because like I say, this will probably never happen again for another 50 years when we have another form of communications that can be breached.
Interesting. Chloe?
Yes, coming up a week this Saturday, CFI Book Club, The Atheist's Guide to Christmas. Saturday, December 11th, 2010, from 1 p.m. to, I think, about 2:30, am I correct?
Yeah, about that.
To the Grind Coffee Shop on Main Street, yes.
Shouldn't that be The Atheist's Guide to Festivus? Or?
Naturally, yeah. But that's not what the book is called. You can call it that if you like.
And, you know, interesting point, Gemma Crite had an article in The Atheist's Guide to Christmas. There is two versions of it. There's the UK version and the, I guess, American version. Either version is acceptable. So
excellent.
read either one you like and come both. Talk about it.
Are they spelled the same, skeptic with a C or skeptic with a K?
There's skeptic is not in the, name of the book. I have a great highlight. My failing history talk for the new Bright Lights lecture series is now online, and I've linked to it on our webpage so you can check it out. And if you want, you can check out, like, Rob's talk is up there too, and a few other people. But mine's really good, so you should check it out. And that's on our website, www.radiofreethinker.com. And of course, if you have a story idea or you want to contribute to Don's idea about what is a good skeptical gift, you can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And of course, feel free to follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT.
Or subscribe on iTunes.
That's right. iTunes is important.
We've got a growing following on that.
Yes. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks so much for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye, everybody.